Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 260, being recorded on October 29th of the year 2000. It's my pleasure once again to present to you Kevin Coogan, the author of the vitally important recent text, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, published in softcover by Otano Media and copyright 1999. Kevin, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
In our past discussions, Kevin, and by the way, I would note for listeners' purposes that those are available from Spitfire, a tape duplication service, time permitting, I will tell you about later. In some of our past discussions, Kevin, we've talked about Francis Parker Yockey, the individual who is the focal point of your book and who is sort of a vehicle for an expose of a fascist international both before, during, and after World War II in particular. Yockey is not a name that's known to most people, but he's very influential in the ranks and annals of contemporary fascism. And by way of helping to string together some names and institutions that people might not be familiar with, ranging from Sieg-Reitz Dienst that we've talked about in the past to Yockey himself, to things that might be more, certainly are known to a certain extent to some people, if not others, let's bring some of these connections up to date. Now, one of the people that you talk about Yockey interacting with is a fellow named Pearson and the Northern League. If you could tell us about him and about Mankind Quarterly briefly. Roger Pearson.
Well, Yockey never actually met Pearson, as far as I could tell. But after Yockey's death, the kind of world around Roger Pearson and the Northern League was very influential in helping to promote Yockey's ideas.
Tell us what the Northern League was, Kevin.
Yes. The Northern League was created in the late 1950s, initially out of Calcutta, India, where Roger Pearson was living. Pearson set up the Northern League as a, quote, pan-Nordic friendship society. And the Northern League published various journals, including a journal called Northern World, which is probably its best-known journal. More importantly, the Northern League served as a gathering point for some of the most extreme radical right-wing figures in Europe and the United States. In the research that I was doing, I was very surprised to find that the Northern League actually maintained close connections with a group called the National States Rights Party in America. Now, most people think of the far right in the 1950s, they think of George Lincoln Rockwell as the most extreme figure in the far right. But the National States Rights Party was a group that had been involved in bombings of synagogues and black churches and another act of terrorism in the South. Now, some of the figures inside the Northern League were very closely tied with the National States Rights Party, and in fact, if you subscribe to the National States Rights Party journal, Thunderbolt, you got a free subscription to the Northern League publication, Northern World. So this group in the American far South was very much linked into, at least on the leadership level, to the Northern League itself. And this is just one example of a whole host of extreme groups that gravitated into the Northern League.
And there are areas of overlap between many of these groups, as you indicate in Dreamer of the Day.
Well, can I say that one of the most important overlaps actually turned out when Roger Pearson himself became the head of the World Anti-Communist League in the late 1970s. Pearson, who was initially based in Calcutta, later came to America and set up his own think tank called the Institute for the Study of Man. He, in turn, through his think tank, published something called Mankind Quarterly, a journal that initially began in Scotland under a man named Robert Gayre, G-A-Y-R-E. Pearson took over that journal, and Mankind Quarterly became a sort of high-level academic, in quotes, type journal promoting race theory. Now, Pearson, at the same time, remarkably moved into a position of being the head of the World Anti-Communist League. And in 1978, at the WACL conference, Pearson invited many extreme rightists from all over the world to attend that conclave.
The World Anti-Communist League, best known in recent years for its American subsidiary, which was utilized by its then-head General John Singlaub as one of the elements in Oliver North's illegal Contra support effort.
Let me say, just to show you how far out Pearson is, Singlaub replaced Pearson at the Northern League, the WACL, precisely because of Pearson's Northern League connections. In other words, Singlaub thought that Roger Pearson was too far right-wing for WACL.
And John Singlamba has never been identified by anybody as a fellow traveler.
Not by me, certainly.
No, and I don't think by much of anybody else. Even at his advanced age, John Singlamba is not somebody that I would want to get into a personal acrimony with.
Yeah.
Not with a history of involvement on the covert side of things. No,
yeah.
Thanks. Now, one of the things that another person whose name is tell us a little bit about Roger Pearson and his promotion of Yaki. Granted that the two never met.
Well, the missing factor here is a man named Willis Cardo.
Mm-hmm.
Because just as I was saying that the Northern League had strong connections in the South with the National States Rights Party, the Northern League also established branches in New York and a branch in California. The branch in California was headed by Willis Cardo. Now, for your listeners who don't know about Cardo, Cardo is today the leading figure in a group called the Liberty Lobby, which is probably the most successful far-right publicity organization today through its publication, the Spotlight. Pearson and Cardo actually met when Pearson came to the United States in 1960 as part of a world tour, which took Pearson from India to Iran to Europe to the United States. Now, after Yaki's death, it was Cardo who published the American edition of the Yaki's famous book, Imperium, for which Yaki's best known.
Mm-hmm. And Cardo is an individual who touches a lot of different bases. We're going to talk about Cardo. My understanding is that he is currently no longer, he's on an out faction of the Liberty Lobby, that actually an anti-Cardo faction is currently in control of the organization.
Well, Cardo's had a lot of problems recently because he lost control of the Institute for Historical Review,
right,
which published it's the leading publisher of No Holocaust propaganda in the United States and actually in the world. So Cardo's fallen somewhat on difficult times, but for about 30 years, Cardo was very close to the epicenter of the far right in the United States.
And again, the Spotlight newspaper of the Liberty Lobby has had a fair amount of circulation, particularly in the last 10 years or so. Perhaps, time permitting, we'll talk a little bit about the conspiracy milieu and how some elements of that overlap some of the things that we're talking about or have been co-opted. Now, Willis Cardo has had a number of different organizations. Tell us about the NYA.
Well, the NYA was the National Youth Alliance, and Cardo created the National Youth Alliance in 1968 in the wake of the George Wallace campaign.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to keep together people from a group especially called Youth for Wallace that Cardo helped finance. And at the end of the George Wallace campaign in 68, Cardo took the cadre from Youth for Wallace and used it to form the National Youth Alliance, the NYA.
Right.
Now, what happened is that he brought in other leading right-wingers, including a man named William Pierce, who had formerly been a leader in George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi Party.
Right.
And the important aspect for me in particular was that the NYA wanted to use and did use Imperium as sort of their foundational text, their theoretical document.
Mm-hmm.
So through the National Youth Alliance, Cardo very much promoted Yaki's ideas.
Kevin, we've talked about the book before, but if you could do the impossible and give us a thumbnail synopsis of Imperium, what basically did that talk about? What is the Imperium, Latin for empire?
Imperium was a book written in 1946 when Yaki was living in Europe, and it called for a kind of new pan-national fascism which would be centered around Europe as an empire. And this empire would be geared to resisting what Yaki called the two sort of outer enemies, namely the United States and Russia. And so the fascism would become much more of a European-based fascism as opposed to a movement that took its direction strictly from Nazi Germany. So Imperium was essentially an attempt to reorient fascist thinking after the fall of the Third Reich, and it was very influenced by the writings of Oswald Spengler, the German philosopher of history who wrote in the 1920s.
Now, Cardo and Pearson and Yaki, how does Willis Cardo influence Pearson and Yaki? If you could explain that relationship to us.
Well, I would say the most important thing that Cardo did is that Cardo became the major figure in getting Imperium's publication in America. Ricardo organized the first edition of Imperium mm-hmm. in America and then has kept Imperium in print for many years thereafter. Ricardo, however, was also very much influenced by racial theory. And in this, Ricardo very much dovetails with Roger Pearson, because Pearson came out of sort of a pseudo-biological theory of race that he helped promote in journals like Mankind Quarterly and the Northern World. The other interesting thing about Pearson is that he also had connections to a group called the International Association for the Advancement of Ethnology and Eugenics,
right,
which had been set up in the late 1950s and was really an attempt to give scientific support to segregationists who argued in court that schools should not be integrated, that blacks were intellectually inferior to whites. So Ricardo was very much also involved in promoting these ideas of racial separatism and sort of race-based science.
Indeed. If I could ask you, Kevin, we've already touched on it, but eugenics is a very important concept, something that anyone studying the history of fascism needs to be familiar with. It's also something that is on the current political front burner to a certain extent, yet it's a term that is not known to most people. Tell me, what is eugenics?
Well, eugenics is basically the idea of racial science. Eugenics had the idea that you could sort of improve the race through breeding techniques, and that through sort of biological approaches to human nature, what people call nature rather than, quote, nurture, different races could be differentiated from different in different ways, so that there would be certain superior races and certain inferior races. That's basically the idea of eugenics.
By the way, as we speak, in October of the year 2000, there was a recent bestseller called The Bell Curve, which drew on some of the eugenics research produced by institutions like the Pioneer Fund, which is of the same milieu as the IAEE. Now, Ricardo, Pearson, and Yaki, how do they influence, how do Ricardo and Yaki influence Pearson?
Well, I would say that the most important aspect of that relationship is really more that Pearson mm-hmm. influenced Ricardo through the Northern League. Before Pearson came to the United States, Ricardo was involved in fairly traditional segregationist organizations, and he was also involved in attempts to kind of create a post-war isolationist right. But with the arrival of Pearson and the Northern League, Ricardo became a much more significant figure in a certain sense, because Ricardo now began to develop these international connections which he had lacked before. As far as I could tell in my research, Yaki and Pearson never had any connection that I was aware of, although there are some interesting clues that Yaki may have been in connection with the Northern League, because I came upon a document where one of the leaders of the Northern League reported that he had met Yaki in England in the late 1950s. The man that I'm referring to is a man named Alistair Harper, and Alistair Harper was the secretary of the Northern League, who was based actually in Scotland, and he wrote, after Yaki died, he wrote a sort of a memoir of Yaki, a very brief memoir, which recounted his meeting with Yaki in London in the late 1950s. However, I've never been able to link Pearson directly to Yaki. I think in part, it could be that I don't know that they did meet, and I just don't know that. But I think more likely, because Pearson spent a lot of his time in India at a time when Yaki was in either Europe or the United States.
Now, Yakiism, as you term it in your book, is something that, again, is not a name or a concept familiar to most people, and yet there are contemporary elements that are trying to keep Yaki alive. One of the things that I was quite struck by, I've become aware of a fascist element within a musical subgenre of the rock scene called black metal, not to be misunderstood. I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing black metal as fascist, but there's definitely a fascist element within it. And I was very struck by Willis Carto's, to coin a term perhaps ubiquitousness, Resistance Records, which is a form of white power, a white power record label, that grew out of the World Church of the Creator, a white supremacist organization that has a band called Rahoa, that sort of operated under its banner. They formed a label called Resistance Records with a magazine called Resistance Magazine. And for a period of time, Carto, according to the Searchlight magazine, not to be confused with the Spotlight, was actually sort of shepherding about. The Liberty Lobby was financing Resistance Records. And that milieu of black metal music, some elements of the conspiracy research milieu, and contemporary, I don't know quite what the term would be, but let's just say anti-establishmentarians, have found, to a certain extent, inspiration or are attempting to gain a voice through Yaquiism. And you write about that in one of your appendices.
Well, ironically, the story of Resistance Records can even be traced back to the National Youth Alliance that we were talking about earlier. Because what happened is that the National Youth Alliance was based on an alliance between Carto, on the one hand, and his fellow William Pierce on the other. Pierce is the person who split from George Lincoln Rockwell's movement after Rockwell was assassinated.
And best known as the author of the Turner Diaries.
Yes, and head of the National Alliance.
Right.
Now, what happened in the early 1970s is that inside the NYA, there was a bitter faction fight between Carto and Pierce. And after that faction fight happened, Carto and Pierce were very much at odds with each other. And the way this relates to Resistance Records is that once Carto began overtures to take over Resistance Records, Pierce, in order to block Carto, actually moved in. And today, it's actually Pierce who is the controller of Resistance.
Right.
And this was highlighted very recently by the arrest of a guy named Henrik Mobus, who was a German out on parole in Germany, who broke parole and came to the United States and was living at Pierce's enclave in West Virginia, helping to organize distribution for Resistance Records in Europe. Mobus, in turn, is a leading figure in what's called the, quote, National Socialist Black Metal scene. So there is a very murky world, and it gets even more murky in my research because I stumbled upon the fact that one of the leading people involved with promoting Yaqui in the 1980s was a fellow named Keith Steinle. And Keith Steinle, in turn, had links to a group called the Abraxas Foundation, which was based at that time in San Francisco and later moved to Denver, which was linked to a man named Boyd Rice,
right,
who's kind of a well-known figure. He's not involved with black metal per se, but he was involved much more with what's called industrial music.
Right.
But ironically, one of the people who has helped promote black metal in the United States is a fellow named Michael Moynihan,
right,
through his book Lords of Chaos, which also discusses in depth Mr. Mobus, the man who's just been arrested in West Virginia. And it turned out that both Moynihan and Rice were working together in the Abraxas Foundation in the late 1980s when Keith Steinle was in contact with them.
The Abraxas Foundation and Michael, not so much the Abraxas Foundation, but Michael Moynihan, a member of that, is in some ways, I don't know if representative is the word, but he has expressed the viewpoint, which is something that one encounters frequently on the far right and in fascist ranks, that what's needed is a new kind of fascism, something that is not your grandfather's fascism or your father's fascism, as you put it in your book. And they're looking for a sort of a post-Hitler, post-Mussolini fascism, and some of these elements are turning to Yaqui for inspiration.
Well, what you're saying is true, but I would make the distinction that Moynihan was a member of the Abraxas Foundation.
Right.
All these sort of kooky far-rightists are always fighting with each other, and so Moynihan had a certain falling out with Boyd Rice, so it's more accurate to say he's a former member of the Abraxas Network.
Yeah.
But it's clear that in that milieu, they all have a certain kind of psychology and a certain worldview, which very much is involved around the promotion of social Darwinism, new ways to fascism, getting over the problems that Hitlerism caused. And it does reflect Yaqui's worldview, because Yaqui looked at Europe after World War II and said the simple fixation on Hitler as the one figure, the one path to the right, was no longer possible given the defeat of the Third Reich. So I don't want to make too heavy or too one-to-one a connection between all these people, but there is a kind of there is a way of thinking that certainly is reflected that you can see reflected in this interest in Yaquism.
One of the things that has been both interesting and disturbing to me is to see how in the last 10 years or so, there's been something of a stratification politically, or in American political intellectual culture, in my opinion. And as conspiracy research, which is a term that I don't like and with which I am frequently identified, has sort of become a cultural slash intellectual slash economic entity in and of itself, there has occurred a sort of stratification in which all conspiracy research has sort of been lumped together and stigmatized. And one of the things that I've noticed is that the Spotlight and the Liberty Lobby have achieved to a certain extent a degree of respectability among some of the researchers in the conspiracy milieu. Certainly, one sees that, sees the publications cited in works that might otherwise appear to be a more enlightened and progressive political presentation.
Yes, I think that's correct. I'm not sure exactly why that has happened. Partly, I think it's the general lowering of political IQ in the United States, but that's undoubtedly going on.
Yeah, one of the things that should be noted is in examining the political heritage of Carto and the elements around him, one finds evidentiary tributaries going all the way back to the Third Reich, with in the connections of people like Francis Parker Yaqui, and I've forgotten the name of the Sicherheitsdienst agent who was very close to.
Oh, do you mean H. Keith Thompson?
H. Keith Thompson, yep. I was fusing a synapse. These are people who actually had documented intelligence connections, operational connections with the Third Reich. And this milieu and people like Otto Ernst Rehmer, actually a member of the SS and one of the people who became part of Hitler's inner circle after the 44 assassination attempt, these are the elements that have sort of given rise to Carto and his milieu to a certain extent. And it is, to me at least, disturbing to see a political heritage like that being accepted so openly and unquestioningly by people who I would have thought would have known better.
Yes, you have to be somewhat cautious, in not making one-to-one correlations. But on the other hand, it's undoubtedly true, as, for example, in the relationship between the Northern League and the National States Rights Party, mm-hmm. that very often there is a international or a transnational aspect to things that we think are basically indigenous American right-wing formations. The real question is that in order to solve these questions, you simply have to do a lot of empirical research to try and understand how these transnational networks work. And sometimes there are connections, sometimes there aren't. You just, but I think, given the internet and given the general increase in communication, number one, that these kinds of relationships are going on much more than we think.
Yeah.
Mobus, for example, is a very good example of that. The fact that Mobus could come over from Germany and link in with Pierce through mm-hmm. Resistance Records is just exactly to this point.
And there was an article in the L.A. Times recently talking about how he appears to have been operating as part of a network, sort of a transnational or international network in this particular regard.
Well, he headed up a group called the National Socialist Black Metal, a distribution group in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through that network that he first came to the United States and then later gravitated to Pierce and Resistance Records and essentially became an employee of Pierce.
Mm-hmm. One of the people who was part of the Abraxas milieu and who also was good friends with Steinle, Moynihan, and also Boyd Rice, granted these people are fractious, is a fellow named Adam Harfrey, who runs a really well-known publishing outfit out of Southern California called Feral House, which at least to a certain extent specializes in, or one of their major genres is conspiracy research. And it's not necessarily I don't want to be misunderstood as stigmatizing Parfrey as a fascist, yet there is a political culture in which these elements are accepted quite readily.
Well, I think the best way to see it, at least initially, is that there's a certain culture of shock
mm-hmm.
and of aesthetic transgression and sort of aesthetic terrorism, which elements from sort of Bohemia are attracted to and like to play around with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of this fascination with conspiracies, serial killers, extreme art, death imagery, etc., really stems initially at least from weird aesthetic rather than well thought out political formations.
Sure.
I mean, unlike someone like a Yockey or a Keith Thompson or a Raymer, who were very much political people, if you want to put it that way, a lot of the so-called kind of right-wing shock radicalism in the United States in the 1980s began as a subset of this broader sort of aesthetic terrorist turn.
Right.
I should mention that I discuss all this in a article that I wrote about a year ago for a publication called Hit List, which then went into exchanges between both myself and Parfrey and other people actually about this whole question.
Right. In fact, for a more detailed and illuminating discussion on this, you cite in your footnotes that article and Parfrey's response and another rejoinder, I guess, through third-party publications, to coin a term.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I stress the point that the black metal music scene is not fascist. It's something which is alien to me, having come across it to a certain extent through the radio work that I do. It is for the purposeful use of an aesthetic that's going to shock people. We should note, though, that there are political elements that are perhaps seeking to ride in on the aesthetic coattails and perhaps exploit
this. Well, this is where Pierce comes in, because Pierce, who is certainly no black metal musician, Pierce is an extremely political person, has spent 40 years in ultra-right-wing politics. It was Pierce who seized upon resistance and black metal as an extremely important argument to get his views across inside cultural scenes that would otherwise not be exposed to his kind of politics, this sort of Nazi-like politics. See, there's no doubt that political operators like Pierce are using or trying to use aesthetic influences through things like black metal music, which is not to say that black metal music is therefore a fascist concoction.
Oh, same. Just as this is not to say that conspiracy research is automatically fascist or right wing, an equation that some recent analysts have made in error, I believe.
Yes, I agree.
All righty. Well, Kevin, I'm going to give the address, et cetera, for Autonal Media so that people know where they can go to get a hold of your book. By the way, I would note for the record that the editing of the book was done by a staff member, Dave Mandel, at WFMU in East Orange, New Jersey, right there in your neck of the woods.
Absolutely.
And Autonal Media can be reached at P.O. Box 568, Williamsburg Station, Williamsburg Station. That's in Brooklyn, New York, 11211-0568, USA. Phone and fax, 718-963-2603. And you can visit their website at www.autonomedia.org. That's AUTONOMEDIA.org. And again, the editing was done by Dave Mantle, a staff member at sister station WFMU in East Orange, New Jersey. For Kevin Coogan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening. This has been For the Record, program number 260, being recorded on October 29th of the year 2000.